50 years ago this week, the television cameras were switched on in the International Amphitheater in Chicago. The Republicans were in town, and Americans coast to coast were squinting at their first live pictures of an American political convention in action. It was 1952. Broadcasting the conventions for CBS was a local Washington, D.C. newsman, a newcomer to broadcasting. By the time the nominations were over 3 weeks later, Cronkite was a star and the phrase anchorman had entered the language. Walter Cronkite now reflects on that summer of 50 years ago that propelled television into politics and him toward fame.
They were the first of 15 conventions I would broadcast over the next 30 years, and the last I would ever see that would actually decide on a nominee. Conventions were wildly unpredictable affairs then. It was a rowdy but instructive kind of charm that in 1952 delighted reporters as much as it troubled the party leadership. The culprit was the camera.
Now to CBS Television News Convention Headquarters and Walter Cronkite.
Good evening, everyone, from our Studio A, the CBS Television Control Point for Westinghouse coverage of the National Convention. Tonight, the fourth session.
As we opened CBS's first coast-to-coast convention telecast, there was a sense of occasion in the air. More than 60 million viewers in 64 cities were curious about the workings of the new medium. So CBS promoted our coverage with a peek behind the scenes. It started with the most important component, the sponsor.
This is the studio, the commercial studio, where Westinghouse will display its products. It will include a fully equipped living room, a dining room, a laundry room, and a kitchen.
It also included Betty Furness, her maid, her secretary, an extensive wardrobe, and an armory of appliances. Some believe Betty got more TV time showing off refrigerators than the candidates got just showing off.
We'll see about that situation in just a moment, but first a word from Westinghouse and Betty Furness.
Think cooking is too much of a job in the summer? Well, it's really cool and easy with the Westinghouse roaster oven. Here's a roaster full of baked beans for your next church supper or picnic.
Television was not the only institution to come to politics that year. There was another intruder that would prove equally persistent.
News reports from our entire staff of more than 25 distinguished news correspondents will be received at this central desk. And the running story of your convention will be coordinated and passed on to the man we call our anchorman.
Anchorman was a new word in 1952. My boss, Sig Mickelson, used that curious word to describe someone who was not exactly a reporter, not exactly a commentator, but a kind of switchboard. Sig might have chosen his anchor from the illustrious CBS News team of World War II, but they were still radio men and wary of the new medium's worthiness, much as print reporters had been wary of them 15 years before. So he turned to an unlikely dark horse who had never before covered a convention.
I'm Walter Cronkite, and I'll be sitting at that anchor desk in 1952. We already were looking forward and planning for this summer's activity. And in the 4 years in between, CBS News correspondents have been studying...
It was an act of faith on Sig's part. I'd been doing Sunday News Special for 18 months in Washington, where I had acquired a reputation for my pronunciation of a certain proper name.
And so for Pepto-Bismol and Sunday News Special, this is Walter Cronkite saying good night.
I was happy to find that there were certain privileges that came with anchoring a convention, but being able to actually see a convention was not one of them. With so much equipment required, I ended up broadcasting from a windowless studio high on the rafters of the amphitheater's north wing, with no sight lines at all to the floor. I may have anchored the convention, but I watched it like everybody else on television. There were several occasions when I was able to go down to the floor while Doug Edwards held down the desk. I carried a huge walkie-talkie device, sometimes thrusting it into unwelcome places.
Now Walter Cronkite has moved over to the Mississippi delegation. Go ahead, Walter.
Yes, Doug, this may be the hot spot. Perhaps the fate of the Democratic Party is being decided in caucuses like this all over this floor. Let's see if we can possibly pick up any of it. Just a moment.
Well, I think they're going to bring it up now. That is the fact. Jeff, wait till we get through here, will you?
Right, they'll see you.
Well, you heard, You heard part of it as Senator Stennis outlines to the, All right, back to Doug Edwards now for the moment.
Technology being what it was in 1952, Edwards sometimes found he had switched to a ghost. There was so much interest in the sheer technology of television, I often found myself doing little lectures on such things as the depth of field ratio of telephoto lenses.
With telephoto lenses, with the lenses that bring the speaker right into your living room, well, it distorts the background a little bit and brings everyone up closer so that actually it looks as if those people are sitting right behind, practically on the shoulders of the speaker. That's not the case. They're several feet away.
You might think that television was more fascinated with itself than the conventions. But these were often fierce and fighting events, and television caught many images far more important than youthful anchors. For the Republicans, no image was more awkward than the door to the National Convention's Credentials Committee in the Boulevard Room of the Hilton Hotel, where Robert Taft hoped his nomination would be sealed. It was awkward because most of the time, that door was closed.
Cameras and microphones will not be allowed until decided by the committee.
With that slam, television itself became a convention issue. Ike's managers began using such unbecoming phrases as Taft-imposed blackout and forced an anti-censorship plank into the platform. To emphasize the news blackout, I had a CBS camera outside the Boulevard Room transmitting a continuous image of that closed door, which I dubbed the glass curtain.
Tonight, the Credentials Committee itself is still meeting downtown at the Hilton Hotel and expects to complete its report for the convention around 10 o'clock tonight, perhaps. Whether it will bring it out to the floor of the convention remains to be seen.
Such moments stir good reporters to enterprise. Word was that NBC tried to sneak a small recorder into the room, only to be spotted by a house detective. At CBS, we were more fortunate. Ted Church and Bill Downs learned the room was equipped with a CBS radio wire for dance band broadcasts. They had the circuit open during the Texas debate and gave the country a brief glimpse of the fires in the smoke-filled room.
When did you start to believe in majority rule?
All my life.
When you came from this up to this convention, and not a single moment before.
I get entitled to reply to that because he was answering my question for me. Mr. Maurer is absolutely not telling the facts. There wasn't a straggler in our convention. Every man there was certified to the Secretary of State. Every single man by a county convention in a county in Texas. There was not a straggler there, Mr. Maurer. Not one! And when you say there were, you're not telling the facts.
When the Credentials Committee proved loyal to Taft, as expected, the stage was set for the convention to accept or reject the committee's approval of Georgia's pro-Taft delegation. Shortly before midnight, Illinois Senator Everett Dirksen took the podium to plead Taft's case. Without a script or a teleprompter, he gave television its first great convention moment.
When my friend Tom Dewey was the candidate in 44 and 48.
The entire speech is worth savoring, but it was those boos that bothered Chairman Walter Hallinan, who seemed to remember something the rest of the convention had forgotten, the television cameras and the huge audience looking in.
This is no place for Republicans to be booing any other Republican.
I assure you that I didn't mean to precipitate a controversy over that section.
Delegates relished Dirksen's oratory, but not his cause. By midnight, the fight was over. It was the end for Taft and the beginning for Eisenhower. Walking back to the Hilton one night, Sig Mickelson and I talked about the week's events. Then he said something that took me by surprise. He told me that I was now a famous man and had better get an agent. I felt flattered and tried not to take it too seriously. But I had crossed a Rubicon, and I knew it. People recognized me on the street now, and the New York Times was calling me for interviews. It wasn't flattery Sig was offering me. It was a warning that the 1952 conventions had changed my life. Any changes in my life, however, were not as important as the changes television had wrought on our political processes. As we watched the Democrats take three ballots, I doubt that any of us would have guessed that this would be the last time this would happen in the 20th century, and likely forever. Both the major parties were chagrined that a huge part of the voting public had watched them fight over their principles, platform, and politics on their convention floors. Any illusion of unity in the parties had been left in the debris of banners, placards, notepaper, and newspapers on those convention floors. The party officials vowed that future conventions would not be permitted to provide such a display for the nation's viewers. They began with the next conventions in 1956 to sweep more and more of the real business, that over which there were genuine disputes, under the rug. They even conducted the business of the Rules and Credentials and Platform Committees, the most important elements of the conventions, in distant cities long before the meeting of the conventions themselves. With the simultaneous acceptance almost nationwide of the primary system, even the selection of the presidential ticket had been completed before the conventions ever met. By the third conventions after 1952, those in 1964, political conventions had, for the most part, metamorphosed into virtually meaningless pep rallies where neither debates nor dispute were tolerated. What the quadrennial meetings had once contributed to the democratic dialogue on which national policy would be based had clashed with their leaders' unwillingness to let the television public participate, even as observers. The political conventions survived the day as sentimental keepsakes, kind of political Disneylands. People ask me occasionally if I miss anchoring today's conventions. No, I don't. I'm ready to leave the coverage to the young reporters, those who never knew the drama, the excitement, yes, the importance of real conventions.